Hello, friends, and welcome to the Gospel Beautiful podcast. I'm your host, Michael Chan. Today's conversation is with Terrence Lester. Terrence is the author of a recently published book with InterVarsity Press called When We Stand, The Power of Seeking Justice Together. I just have to admit this conversation really took me by surprise in a couple different ways. First of all, I didn't know Terrence or about him prior to, I don't know, maybe a couple months ago, when one of the editors, one of the marketing folks at IVP reached out and said, hey, this might be a good Terrence might be a good podcast guest for you. And so, you know, I worked through the book, kind of looked into Terrence, and I thought, yeah, this is really interesting. Terrence is the founder of Love Beyond Walls, which is a nonprofit organization focused on poverty awareness and community mobilization. He's also the leader and founder of a campaign called Hashtag Love Sinks In, which provides hand washing stations for the poor, especially during the time of COVID. And so it's a national campaign, really interesting and obviously meeting a really important need. So I was just moved by the work that Terrence is doing. But then when we jumped into the conversation, I think you're going to hear that I was also surprised and moved just by his passion and by his sense of calling and by his sense of the mission that he is on, that he feels called to by the Spirit. So I think you're going to appreciate especially the energy of this conversation and also just the concrete work that Terrence is doing. So any more delay, just make sure to recommend any artists to me that you might be interested in hearing on the podcast. And otherwise, we're going to hear just a few words from our sponsors right now and then turn straight to the conversation. Thanks everyone for joining me. Baker Academics serves the academy and the church by publishing works that further the pursuit of knowledge and understanding within the context of Christian faith. They connect authors and readers across the broader academic community by publishing books that reflect historic Christianity and its contemporary expressions. Baker Academic authors are scholars who are leaders in their fields, write ironically, and display a healthy respect for other perspectives and traditions. Baker Academic is a proud sponsor of the Gospel Beautiful podcast. Thank you for listening.
Hey there, Gospel Beautiful podcast listeners. This is Brian Schrader, creator of Worship Forward, a resource for progressive, innovative worship leaders. Here you'll find conversations about arranging hymns for your worship band, using song lyrics that promote justice, and how to choose great worship songs to use at your church. Check it out at worshipforward.blog.
Terrence Lester, thanks for joining me on the conversation today.
Hey, Michael, it's great to be here. I'm excited about our conversation.
Yeah, so am I. Thanks for this book, When We Stand, and I guess as a starting point, congratulations on its publication.
Yeah, I'm really excited about this book. It is a message that is needed for right now. I believe we're in a moment in history where more than ever, we need to hear messages like togetherness and taking a stand together, however that fleshes out in the many different contexts around the country as well as the world. Yeah.
No, I think you're right about that. There is this book is a call to so many different things related to homelessness and justice, but also unity. Like there is this kind of heartbeat of unity that is at the center of this book that I really appreciated. And you lift up kind of two different ministries, if I understand it correctly. One is Love Beyond Walls, and then Love Sinks In. And Love Sinks In is sort of the emerged, I think, in the context of COVID. But I wonder if you just tell us a bit about the history of those two ministries.
Yeah, so Love Beyond Walls started in 2013. I actually launched the organization with a campaign that is, you know, well known. My family allowed me to live on the streets for a little over a month, going through the tangible experiences of homelessness. And so I documented all of these stories and experiences for my cell phone. And I guess the passion kind of arose out of a twofold nature. Like, one, I had experienced homelessness when I was a teenager for a brief moment, but really didn't have the articulation of understanding the trauma and the experiences that I was going through. I just remember, you know, my teachers labeling me because they didn't understand why I was falling asleep in my high school classes. And two, I saw this growing apathy and distance from this very vulnerable population. You know, sometimes people think that because you're experiencing homelessness that maybe you have a mental health issue, or, you know, you're lazy or you're addicted to drugs. And that's not always the case. The experience of homelessness is not necessarily monolithic, right? People come into this plight from many different avenues. I mean, one of the leading factors of the experience of homelessness is a loss of job. And I think that is very apropos to the times that we're living in. So many people lost their jobs. A lot of people have been furloughed. Right now, statistics are showing that by 2023, homelessness will increase by 40% because of the residue of what happened during COVID-19. And so Love Beyond Walls was kind of born out of this idea of wanting to make people aware of the real raw realities of what people go through second by second, but also using that awareness as a tool of education, because I believe education actually leads to compassion and more empathy. And right now we have an empathy deficit in our world. And also, I would say thirdly, man, we just love to build community around those who are living on the margins of society. We create a community of welcome, and we have walked alongside many individuals, hundreds of individuals in the last 7.5 years out of the experience of homelessness. And so, yeah, that passion just all collided together. And Love Sinks In is a campaign that we actually launched from our organization around, you know, the beginning of COVID. We started to notice this trend of people experiencing homelessness not having access to the basic necessity of soap and water. And we had all of these, you know, guidelines coming from the television and the CDC saying, you know, you need to wash your hands. That's the primary way to protect yourself against the spread and contraction of COVID-19. And we've known this during research that hand washing has always been a tool to prevent the spread of diseases. Hand washing has always been a tool that helped to prevent the spreading of viruses and diseases in countries all around the world. And so we had this guy in our center named Dimitri, and he was in tears, and he told our team that he was afraid that he would pass away because he thought that he would contract COVID because he had nowhere to wash his hands. And so our ministry pivoted from a more centralized model to a decentralized model. And we started to dream about how we could use a creative way to get access of hand washing to this vulnerable population. And that's when I had the idea to start placing sinks in the street. And we started with 5. We grew to 15. The story started to spread more. We had all these major companies getting involved, and we spread this campaign to 62 cities all around the country, as well as 2 additional countries. And so on any given week, we had 30,000 plus people washing their hands and having access to sanitation. And I kind of viewed this framework as, you know, hand washing was synonymous with feet washing that Jesus displayed in the scriptures.
Oh, that's powerful, Terrence. And yeah, the story about Dimitri in the book is, well, this book is just kind of filled with powerful stories like that one. But this hand washing idea, you're just taking such a basic kind of human need that really gets accentuated during the pandemic, and you guys just figure out a way to creatively meet it. And tell me about some of the sort of the technological side. I think at one point you had like an RV with with, like, you know, with a sink in it, but like, what would these look like on the street if somebody were to come up on one?
Yeah, so basically, it's a self-contained unit. It has a 5 to 10 gallon tank on the bottom of it, with a foot pedal, and it has, you know, this connector to, you know, a basin, and the basin has, you know, a pump for soap. And basically, we were placing these and still place them even to this day in alleyways, in public parks where many people experiencing homelessness frequent, and outside of churches, those that would allow us to place them where a lot of foot traffic is, in partnerships with shelters and underneath bridges and all these various places. And a person can just walk up to it and literally pump the pedal on top of the tank, and it shoots up water through the spout into the basin, and a person is able to wash their hands. And it has a gray water drain connected to the bottom of the basin, so the water actually drains into another container to capture that as well. And so, you know, I was just trying to think of a way that we could be more proximate, regardless of the quote-unquote social distancing that was supposed to happen. I think this population of people were being forgotten about even more during the height of the pandemic, because this population of people have always experienced social distancing, right? When you think about the laws and ordinances that prohibit people from sharing food, that prohibit people from standing in public places, that prohibit people from carrying multiple bags with them. Like in cities across the country, you can be fined for a camping violation for having multiple bags. There's even a city in South Carolina that flat outright banned sleeping outside, period. So like if you're caught sleeping outside, you can be arrested, right? And so there has always been this idea of distancing ourselves from people going through this plight. And what I've always called for, even in my last book, I See You, was that we need to affirm the dignity, the very imago Dei, of people experiencing homelessness. But because just because a person doesn't have an address does not mean that they're not our neighbor.
Yeah, that's a powerful way of putting it. You mentioned your own experience with homelessness as a youth. And then I think you also said that you spent some time, I think, as an adult, like intentionally living among the homeless. Is that right? Can you just say something about those experiences and then kind of how they shaped and changed you as a person?
Yeah. When I was a teenager, you know, it was infrequent. It was more acutely experienced, where I would sometimes sleep in a park and sometimes stay with friends that would allow me to sleep on the floor or a couch, etc. And, you know, during those moments, it was a bunch of pain because I was still wrestling from my social location, trying to make sense of my surroundings, of, you know, my family of origin, of my identity, you know, who am I in this world, trying to discover even, you know, the systemic things that I heard about in community that could be very oppressive to me. But I had a mentor. My friend's father, Mr. Moore, came into my life, and he was a pastor. He loved his family. He was probably the first man I ever saw to like just be present in his family. And he would always call out the leadership in me, even when I was, you know, rough around the edges and I was kind of searching myself. And I'll never forget him calling me a leader a night that I was going to sleep in the park at like 16 and a half years old. I mean, I'm like, what do you mean I'm a leader? How can you say this? Nothing about my surroundings or my social location suggests that I'll one day be a leader or that I am a leader. But he saw something in me, and he used to always talk to me about how God uses our circumstances and sometimes gives us a testimony to relate to other people who are also going through similar issues. And fast forwarding, I overcame a lot of those obstacles, went on to go to college, got married. I'll celebrate 15 years in August, have two beautiful children, you know, have even been invited back to the high school that I was put out of to give like graduation talks. So like God really did a 180 in my life in many ways. And I'll never forget Mr. Moore encouraging me to think about ministry and how that would flesh out. And the more education I, you know, started to receive, the more passionate I became about articulating and advocating on behalf of people that I could identify with. And I'll never forget reading this passage in the scriptures where Jesus goes through this wilderness experience. And then in Matthew 9, it says that he saw people and they were weary and they were broken and they were scattered. And he was moved with compassion.
That is an amazing passage, isn't it? It's incredible. Yeah.
Like, it's like, that is it. I wanted to allow the way that I follow Jesus to move me with compassion for those who are broken and weary. Why? Because I myself have been broken and weary.
Yeah, I love that story about how Jesus looks out and is just moved. It's like this sort of inner groaning in him, like, ugh, you know, it's not something intellectual. It's like he feels it in his body. And it's such a powerful story. And it sounds like that's kind of been your experience too.
Yeah. I mean, of course, intellectually I've grown and, you know, books became my mentors, so to speak. I started to amass this, you know, book collection. I went to Bible college and seminary, but I always left my heart, my emotions, my will, and my intellect open to allow God to really build this passion up on the inside of me. And so, you know, I like to see it as, you know, if I am wanting to serve, I also have to be willing to take off my shoes of comfort, which led me to, you know, take off my shoes, so to speak, to serve and to live among, also wanting to follow Jesus's lead when it says he dwelt among him, right? The word became flesh. And that's kind of like the how I live out incarnationally the ministry that God has given me, because, you know, it's really hard to serve people that you're not proximate to. And it's even harder to serve people when you're not presence or practicing the ministry of presence, right? Some of our greatest campaigns and our ideas from our organization has arisen from us listening and sitting with people who are suffering because God is speaking through their suffering.
Terrence, as you kind of, so you've had a ton of life experience. You've also gone through a lot of education. Like, as you look back on all that, what are some of the books that you feel like have most impacted you in the way that you think about what God's calling you to do?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I would be really Christian right now and say the Bible and the New Testament.
That's allowed here.
Really, yeah, I mean, the Gospels, specifically the Gospel of Luke. I just love how Jesus crosses lines and sees those persons who would be normally excluded in society. I love the Gospel according to Luke. As Luke records it, he really does a really great job at ensuring the reader or those of us who are in the audience. He makes us aware how Jesus is a person for the unseen, right? The marginalized, the excluded. And that gospel really shaped my heart for the work that I'm doing. But like books like The Prodigal God by Tim Keller is a really great book that really, that's the first, I would say that's the first book I read and really cried, right? Well, where I really saw the parable of the lost son as, you know, something more, much more robust than just like, oh, this guy, you know, chooses to forsake his father and goes away and spends all of his goods. He really did a great job at really unpacking the son that stayed and how we move from this, you know, God pursuing us, and we enter into this the family of God, the beloved community, and then we kind of lose our way, not realizing that we have all of these glorious riches around us, right? It just kind of shaped my heart to see that the gospel is both in. It's not only for those who are considered outsiders, right? Because we're trying to extend the table of welcome, but it's also this gospel that continues to fuel and reignite us every single day, every chance we get a chance to consume it. The Ragamuffin Gospel is another great book.
Classic.
That was given to me, yeah, from one of my professors. And but I could go on and on and on, but it's the gospel that grounds me, bro.
You know what's amazing about you just mentioned the prodigal, you know, story of prodigal son from Luke 15, and like the father reacts also where he says he's filled with compassion. You know, just yes. It's like this, you know, it's the same kind of idea that you just brought up from the stories of Jesus.
Yeah, I mean, bro, like he lifts up his robe, he stands and he's like waiting, right? It should be a moment where you think the father would go, I told you, you know, you squandered everything, you're in trouble, and you know, it's just
arms like crossed, kind of like,
you know. right it's countercultural, right? It's instead of putting up walls, he extends welcome and then he throws a party. Right? And it's like, That is one of the most powerful messages that we try to embody, even as an organization, that, you know, it's amazing when we encounter people experiencing homelessness and they have been looked over so much that when we say, call them by their name or, you know, extend love or just want to sit with, they are kind of like shocked. Because society and culture has wired them to believe that they are unworthy. And it's like, no, you are still the beloved of God. And we get a chance to have these celebratory moments with our friends in community.
Yeah, that's powerful. I wonder, Terrence, is there like a story that comes to mind from like last year, a couple of years, that really, like, when you think about that story, you say, that is what we're after. You know, that's what we're trying to do. Is there something like that that comes to mind?
Yeah, I remember we were having this moment where we had a bunch of volunteers in our center. We had a few guys that were staying with us. We were helping them to, you know, regain access to their identification cards and reunite with family members. And this guy named Ronald comes to the front door and he knocks and he says, "Hey, there's a guy in the back. He's digging in your dumpster." And instead of like reacting in a very negative way or calling the police, I walk around the building and I engage Mark and I ask him his story. Mark was literally digging in a dumpster for lunch, right? I took a few moments, got a chance to know him, and I extended the table of welcome. I said, "Hey, brother, would you want us to like walk with you?" And he was kind of taken aback and he says, "Well, yeah." He opens up a little more. He says that he was once in corporate America. He became homeless and was living on the streets for about 6 years. He got really depressed and lost everything. A couple weeks prior, he had tried to commit suicide. And we walk him around the building. We walk him in and like all of our volunteers are like high energy and like just full of love and wanting to, you know, love on people. And I introduce him. I say, "Hey, this is Mark. He's going to be one of our, you know, community members." And people were like hugging on him and like trying to get to know him. And he was just like really shocked because, you know, he's so used to being put out of coffee shops or asking, you know, to leave or having the police called on him. But long story short, brother, he started to live within our community, and we walked with him. It took us about 8 months to actually get his ID back, just a birth certificate, because you need ID to get ID. And we had to hire an attorney to solicit for all of these records. A year with being involved, he became a leader, one of the volunteer leaders in our community. And then we launched this campaign where we had some people come in and do his resume, and we got him a job. And Mark is literally like on his own, self-sufficient. We talk, he's a friend. He's been back to volunteer. He's back in corporate America. I mean, he's reunited with his kids. I mean, it's just like...
It's unbelievable.
Bro, it's...
Incredible.
It's the Lord. It's... And people think that it's quick fixes. It's not. It's long-suffering. It's continuing to show up and walk with people. It's seeing the best in people, even in the worst of their circumstances. It's what Jesus has done for us. You know, and it's the Father standing on the edge, lifting up his robe, saying, "Welcome home," you know, and that's what we kind of try to embody.
Man, that's a powerful story. What an incredible story. I wanted to kind of pivot to ask you a couple questions about the leadership parts of the book, because there's a lot, you know, just like your mentor when you were a young kid said, like, there's a lot of leadership in you, and there's a lot of leadership in this book. And I just wonder, like, for organizations like Love Beyond Walls and Love Sinks In, like, what are the biggest challenges that you face as a leader in those, you know, two organizations?
Brother, the number one thing that I tell people that I do in the role in this ministry is trying to convince people to care about other people.
Yeah.
Fighting apathy is one of the hardest challenges that I have faced to date. I mean, you think about it. People are numb. People are indifferent towards others. Sometimes even, you know, believers say, you know, I love God with everything, but I want to love my neighbor as myself, but they miss the neighbor part, right? It's the challenge of trying to get people to see people who are constantly made invisible in society and culture. It's, you know, trying to develop empathy in people and to get them to live outside of themselves. And it's even, you know, another challenge is fighting against this event mentality of service, right? You know, where service becomes this thing that we check off on a box or we kind of do a few times a year. And as a believer, I'm really trying to get people to understand that service is a lifestyle. It's you can serve where you live, where you work, where you play. You can serve if you're passing someone and notice them and ask them their name. It should be out of the overflow, and we should embody it as an act of worship, not necessarily to earn our right in the beloved community or our salvation, but as an act of saying, God, I am so humbled by what you have done through Jesus that I want to respond in the same ways that Jesus has lived his life. And so those things are things that I fight every day, and it's really tough. It's tough.
You know, I want to, thanks for kind of framing it that way. I want to return to kind of the chapter 5 part of the book where you talk about think we, not me, which is, I think, part of what you're saying here. But as I was reading the book, I found myself, I kept going back to Abraham Joshua Heschel's book called The Prophets, which if you haven't read it, I hope you will. And here's from page 4, just a little excerpt. He's talking about the prophet Amos, right? Somebody who also has a lot to say about poverty and people who are kind of under the boot that way. So here's the quote. Indeed, the sort of crimes and even the amount of delinquency that fill the prophets of Israel with dismay do not go beyond what we regard as normal, as typical ingredients of social dynamics. To us, a single act of injustice, cheating in business, exploitation of the poor, is slight, but to the prophets, it's a disaster. To us, injustice is injurious to the welfare of the people. To the prophets, it is a death blow to existence. To us, an episode, to them, a catastrophe, a threat to the world, unquote. And like what I love about what he says, I feel like you have the same kind of urgency, you know, in the book, where like this whole business about like, fighting apathy.
Yes.
That's what I think the prophets fight too. It's like, yeah, poverty, that's just the normal part of how the world works. It's always going to be there. We live and go on and do our lives. But like for these prophets, it is like this cosmic disaster.
Yes. It's yes. And it's a weight. And it's something that is crying out from the soil, so to speak. And, you know, prophets within the Old Testament, you're an Old Testament scholar, they foretell and they foretell, right? And so it's like this groaning and this crying out in this present moment. Hey, guys, like this is something that we should be paying attention to. It's something that grieves the very anthropomorphic heart of God, right? You know, it's this idea of trying to gather people to pay attention. And it doesn't happen in a silo. And that's kind of what I'm lifting up in this chapter about, you know, if your theology only includes you, your family and no more is not really a theology. It's a meology. It's like, how can we come together to address these things that the Lord clearly speaks about in the text? Yeah.
Yeah. So you have a nice quote here from Father Boyle, who I think is a friend, colleague of yours. And let's see. He says, you know, there is no them and us. There is only us. And I think he's absolutely right about that. I think like the hardest part about leadership, whether it's in a congregation or maybe in a situation like yours, it is just helping people realize that their self-interest is caught up like in our interest.
Yes.
Like that's the same thing is what I mean to say. But why is that argument so hard to make?
Well, I think it's hard to make, and it's a wonderful point that you raise. I think it's hard to make because we have been hardwired with a individualistic mentality that's kind of cultivated in Western society, right? Where it's, you know, I strive, you know, I secure success, you know, I amass wealth, you know, it's I, right? And these messages are reinforced by social media, the way that we are marketed to, you know, they spend billions of dollars every year to market health and beauty products. You know, it's just all focused on me. And so like personal self-gratification becomes literally an idol. I mean, it's the thing that rules the heart of American culture. it's all about me.
I think that's true.
And so you wrap Christianity up into that, and we approach God the same way. You know, what can I get from God? You know, how can God serve me? You know, it's my God. It's not, you know, I'm serving God. And so it's hard to like break people out of that mentality because everything around us talks about ourselves, you know? And it's like, no, Jesus came with this countercultural message. You know, he came talking about the beloved community. He came talking about all of God's family as opposed to just you, yourself, and nobody else.
Well, and you talk in the book about like isolation as a problem.
Yes.
Like you name it specifically, and you're not talking just about like social isolation, you know, sort of being socially distanced. Like you see it as a much bigger kind of phenomenon. Can you sort of fill out that picture a bit and tell us what you mean and tell us what you think like the remedy is or one way to address
it? Yeah, that's a great point, because isolation is not just individualized. It can be communal, where we isolate entire communities, where we put up, you know, security fences, or we see, you know, in a very monolithic way, our community members or who we identify as being a part of our community, even if community members are very diverse socioeconomically, in terms of culture and race. We kind of like monopolize who we want to be in our community. And people do that for many different reasons. I mean, some out of fear, some out of just elitism, you know, wanting to separate, some out of just being really comfortable with what we're familiar with. But what I'm kind of lifting up is that we have to shift our mentalities from like this insulated bubble to opening ourselves up to realize that we're a part of a much larger tapestry and a much larger fabric, if you will. Martin Luther King says it this way: it's the world house. You know, the world is our address. You know, he has this phraseology that I lift up in the book where he's given this Christmas sermon, and he's talking about you can't even wake up in the morning and not have a global experience. Where did you get your coffee from? Where did you get, you know, your favorite shirt from?
And he didn't even like live in our age, right? Like,
you know what I mean? And he's just communicating this very interconnected message, which I think is so appropriate. And I think one of the ways is that we need to talk about this type of messaging more from our pulpits, in our seminaries, in the way that we hold and host conversations, you know, baking in this mentality of interconnectedness, as opposed to always speaking to the individualized message of what can one single person achieve. And I also think that we need to model this in the ways that we you know, ecumenically, within the context of church, right? You would be amazed at the number of faith communities that won't even work with each other, but all claim Jesus. You know, it's like,
yeah.
What?
So okay, let me ask this question. Yeah, no, I hear what you're saying. So you're a seminary educated guy. You've got, you know, this education. This is kind of a self-serving question, and you don't have to like name where you went to seminary or anything like that. That's not the point. But like, did your education, like your theological education, like where did it help you? Where did it not help you? And where, like, from your perspective, do you feel like there needs to be some work done here? The way we educate leaders in theological spaces,
brother. I will be fully transparent. I'd gone to Bible college and to seminary, and obviously I was a minority. And I'll never forget my spiritual shaping happening in a predominantly Black church. And I'm going to seminary and I'm a minority. And coming in contact with the information that there are over 34,000 different branches or denominations of the Christian faith, and realizing that, you know, my white brothers and sisters in these spaces would never darken the doors of the social location that I was in, and like trying to figure all of this out. And it wrecked me, because here it is, we're studying how Jesus you know, got close to tax collectors and healed the sick and touched the dead and like opened blinded eyes and worked on the Sabbath and did all of these things. And yet I did not see that realized in my theological education and formation and the way that I experienced church. And those were in conflict with one another. And I struggled because I'm asking God and myself and my professors, why is it this way? You know, why is Sunday the most segregated hour, as ML King raised? Why can I still be overlooked in predominantly white institutions in seminary, and I'm also a believer and a brother in Christ? So I was having all of these existential questions. And, you know, I believe through all of that wrestling and searching and having conversations, it kind of made me more compassionate to want to follow Jesus even more. I can say one of the things that I think needs to change in theological educational spaces is the way that we engage in conversations about diversity and inclusion, and not trying to monopolize. You know, I remember God. You know, I remember reading this book called "What Color Is Your God?" Right, in my theological shaping, and it's like, we need to have these real robust conversations about how God is a mosaic, that nobody has, you know, a monopoly on God, right? And that God is expressed throughout all of creation and everybody is welcome. We need to have some real serious conversations around equity and equality in theological spaces. But we also need to do, you know, some really important work of empowering voices that are excluded and overlooked, specifically persons of color. And so I'll leave you with that.
No, that's great, Terrence. Well, let me kind of ask a follow-up question. So this is a fictional scenario. So you've been invited to speak at a church. Let's just imagine that it's a largely white congregation, okay, that well-meaning people that are eager to do the work of justice, they don't have to read your book to be convinced. They're already convinced. We want to do this, you know, but they, you know, it's a church that's very much, it doesn't have any diversity in its midst. What do you say to the elder or whoever it is that stands up and says, how do we get started? You see how we are. This is where we're at. You know, we have almost no relation to, you know, very little contact with people of color here in our congregation. Where do we get started with this conversation?
Yeah, I think that's an important question. And I think that is not something that you solve in one conversation. I think you have to have a discernment phase of asking yourself questions like, what's around us? You know, what is happening?
Yeah. What a great
what
question.
Is happening in the context of where we're socially positioned? You know, what is God up to around us? And I think taking a really good assessment of the communal space or the environmental space that surrounds this church, you know, not just solely looking for disparity, but just going, hey, what is happening around us? And sitting with that and coming up with all of these points after you've done your, you know, your assessment of community. I think from there, you need to ask what is in us, right? Which is a very important question, because sometimes churches make the mistake of trying to copy and paste what another church is doing, right? Because a passion has arisen in a church and they're like, oh, they're killing it in that area. Let us just copy and paste. And just like, no, like, have you taken an assessment of what God is speaking through the collective skills and talents and ideas and the gifts of persons that are in the context of community. Because you may, I mean, obviously, we don't want our churches to be monolithic, but sometimes, you know, doctors will go to churches with other medical doctors, and like school teachers will kind of go to church with other school teachers. I mean, communities kind of build themselves out like that. And I think taking a real good assessment of, you know, what the community has to offer in terms of, gifting capital, if you will, helps to start to think about, like, okay, we see this happening around us or in our context or in our social space. And we also see, you know, what kind of God has kind of wired our community with in terms of people resources, right? And then the next question beyond that is, how can we leverage what God has resourced us with to develop a rhythmic plan to start showing up? Not showing up in a big way, but showing up in a small way. Because I'm really against like the whole parachute model of like dropping in and we do this big thing. It's like, no, you build out consistency over time in a very small way and organically continue to build relationships, build out opportunities for people to get plugged in within the context of your community of faith. And you build these things out over time and you slowly mature them and grow them. And that's how the ministry forms within the context of church, as opposed to let's pick one thing, let's do something good, let's celebrate it from stage and move on to the next thing. It's like, no, this real interrogation work that you have to do and constantly sit with those questions.
I love those two questions, Terrence. What's around us and what's in us? I just feel like a congregation could live with those questions for like years, you know, like it just explore those questions, what's around us and what's in us. And I think this is related to something you talk about in the conclusion, where you talk about the difference between serving and receiving. And I thought that was a pretty important distinction. Can you kind of, and this gets to kind of your parachute model too, right? And like sort of big event style of service. It's like, we're here to serve, but like you want to call us to something that's a little bit different.
Yeah. I'm really calling people to the ministry of presence, the ministry of showing up, and the ministry of receiving people. And when I talk about receiving people, I'm lifting up something Father Gregory Boyle stated when we were sitting on a panel together a few years back. He says, the idea of sharing God's love is simply about receiving people. That's deep, you know, because oftentimes we try to make people projects, or we try to like, you know, enforce some type of standard on people of how they should be. We try to assimilate people really quick. And, you know, that's one of the ways in which not only can we do real damage and hurt people and push people away from the Jesus that we're trying to embody, but it communicates this idea that people are just like things to check off, as opposed to like people that we receive. I go back to the passage that we lifted up about, you know, the father standing on the edge, waiting to receive his son, not with shame, not with guilt, not with pointing the finger, not with, you know, this mentality of trying to just like, the text doesn't even say he gave him a shower, right? It's just like he just wanted to receive him with love. And I think that's starkly different from how we have used service, the word service, when we think that we're only showing up to do something for poor people, or we're only showing up to do something for people who are less than, right? When you talk about receiving, not only do you receive people, but you make yourself vulnerable to also be received. And that is the point that I'm lifting up.
This is a powerful point. One last question, Terrence. You at one point talked about a new American dream. And I just wonder, how do you imagine that dream? What does that sort of look like in your own minds, in your heart's eye? And then, do you think we're at all moving in that direction? Or do you see places where, like, if you were to imagine it sort of as a garden, like where that's growing?
I think we're primed and ready for that. I think COVID-19 has made people aware of things that they have been inattentionally blind to. I think we have gotten this clarion call, right, through crisis and circumstance, that we need to be about togetherness and in unity and seeing the whole community and really showing up for neighbor, you know. I think the new American dream is one of sacrifice. It's one of not putting off what we plan to do after we've amassed a certain amount of wealth, but seeing this real crucial moment of being involved now. It involves, you know, reevaluating what we have as priorities. It, you know, it calls us to, you know, be more about the things that God is calling us to care for and show up for, as opposed to being standoffish or being exclusive or being in our bubbles. It calls us to have hearts of wanting to be present and wanting to receive people and wanting to incarnationally live like Jesus. It calls us to do all, it calls us to live the gospel, man. I mean, it's nothing new. I'm just trying to say it in a different way. And I think we are in a place where there's this longing of what is next. You know, that's kind of like a question that is not being spoken, but it's kind of like something that I feel we are all sensing. What is next with the church, right? How does the church move forward and really, you know, embody the gospel where it's fresh and it's alive and it's transformational and not transactional? And that's what I see. Yeah.
Well, Terrence Lester, I am so grateful that your publisher put us in touch. I appreciate your joy. I appreciate your love for the gospel and most especially your love for people. Thank you for what you're calling us to in your book, When We Stand. I hope that people will check it out. It's a great read. It's really well written, has some incredible stories and insights that I think are really inspired and powerful. So Terrence, thanks for your time and blessings on your ministry.
Michael, thank you so much for having me here. It was a blessing to talk to you, brother.
Thank you for listening to the Gospel Beautiful podcast. I really hope that you benefited from the conversation. If you did, make sure to leave a 5-star review. Also, make sure that you're subscribed so that you can receive updates whenever new episodes drop. Thank you very much.